Welcome to EI Talks. I'm joined by Suzanne Raine, visiting professor at King's College London. And today we're going to discuss the nature of terrorism and give a long view on the history of global jihad in light of the terrorist outrage at Croker City Hall in the outskirts of Moscow. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Alistair.
Do we take terrorism seriously enough?
We obviously take it very seriously in terms of devoting a huge amount of resource to protecting our citizens and disrupting terrorist groups around the world where they're organising to carry out terrorist attacks that are going to kill innocent people. But I think that an argument has been made very strongly that terrorism is not a strategic act, that it's essentially criminals who are motivated by some kind of grievance and anger and take opportunities. And I struggle with that because I think, firstly, it belittles what's actually motivating people to undertake political violence, which terrorism is by definition, certainly in the British law, it has to have political or racial or ideological or religious motivation. So that's the distinction between terrorism and other forms of violent crime. So firstly, you're belittling the fact that it has a political cause. And then you're sort of negating or removing the possibility of thinking about the fact that this requires a strategic solution, a diplomatic solution. It's in many instances, it's a part domestic, part foreign policy issue. And to separate it off and say this is a domestic issue, this is something police and security services do, misses massively opportunities to look at it more strategically. So my argument has consistently been over 20 years on Afghanistan, is that the Foreign Office absented itself in the UK, sort of, not completely, from a diplomatic and strategic solution. I mean, that's sweeping, probably not fair. But actually what really undermined Afghanistan was a continuing diplomatic fight between India and Pakistan, who were each supporting rival factions in order to make sure that the eventual, what happened in Afghanistan, was to their benefit. And somehow we never really talked about it like that. We never saw it as being a contest between Iran and Russia and India and Pakistan. We saw it as a contest between us and the Taliban. And I think that was a mistake, definitely. But also, I don't honestly think that the Taliban themselves had a set of political objectives. And we're going to come on and talk about this idea of when terrorists, when they feel that they've met their objectives. So I think the Taliban are a really interesting example because they have compromised in a way. They're seen by more radical versions of the Islamists to have sold out slightly because they've got a state now.
Yeah. I mean, on the Taliban, ISIK, Islamic State, Khorasan province, has been alleged to have been responsible among the many sort of franchises of Islamic State. Could you give a sense of those organisational sort of frameworks, those organisations, those franchises, where global jihadism, where the energy is at the moment?
Well, I should say, and this, you're not going to want this for the podcast, but I am not current on all of this and I'm not going to pretend to be. And I think that there's been an awful lot of commentary from people who are going to tell you they know exactly what's going on. And every time you hear someone say that, you should immediately stop listening, because if one of the things that is so difficult for people in the West at the moment is that we're not there. And particularly in the case of Khorasan, the bits that are Central Asia have never really been the focus of our activities. So we were never looking at how many Uzbeks and how many Tajiks and how many Kazakhs were going to fight in Iraq and Syria, except to say that there are lots of them, and Chechens as well. So there was a very well-known Chechen called Abu Omar Shishani, who ended up, he'd been a Georgian, actually, in the Georgian army, and then he went quite early on to Syria and ended up running the foreign fighter network there. So with the exception of people like Abu Omar Shoshani, there were a large number of Central Asians that people in the West couldn't catalogue or follow, because they're from someone else's country, far away. It's all very complicated, and that's all sort of just happened.
Our main category, I guess, is Francophone and then converts in terms of the way we think about people who went to join Islamic State. Like, the overwhelming focus was on Francophone.
Well, no, so our focus was on British people.
No, I mean just in Europe in general. But if you looked at the stats, it was Francophone, Franco-Belgian people made up the vast proportion of people going from Europe.
Yes, but I suppose I would argue that our main focus was on the Brits, and there were some very powerful, you know, some very prominent Brits who did some horrific things out there. And always, for every country, the problem that you're focused on is your nationals, because they're the ones who are speaking back into your communities, who might come back, who are going to particularly be focused on acts against the country that they came from or the civilization that they understand and want to destroy in some way. So the French, obviously, there's a Francophone thing, which is big. There was a huge movement of North Africans to Syria and Iraq, which is a real problem for North African countries. Yeah. I don't know how many of them have come back. I honestly don't know how many of them survived and where they are now. And so coming back to the Central Asia thing, or the Khorasan, it's really complicated because it's, firstly, Khorasan, by definition, the whole purpose is it's not a state. It existed before national state boundaries, and it goes beyond them. That enables it to incorporate a whole load of different ethnic groups, and that would include the Uzbeks and the Tajiks in large numbers, but also disaffected parts of Pakistani Taliban. I mean, it's a real mush. And the reason that matters is because you end up with ethnic divides. So you have people of Turkic origin, Arabic origin, and the Pashtuns, and, you know, sort of ethnic different parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they all have slightly different narratives and slightly different objectives.
What always struck me about the Islamic State's literature was the great emphasis on "we are not a national unit," which is the kind of fundamental contradiction of Islamic State. It did have a territory, but it always wanted that territory to expand eventually to include the whole planet.
Yes.
Which explains why you can say, with this global community, we have people from Africa, we have people from Europe, we have people from all over the world. It comes up again and again and again in the literature. So it's very interesting seeing the way it's evolved over the last 10 years, the different monikers. You know, you had Islamic State of Al-Sham, Islamic State of Levant, just IS. Because that was supposed to be the definitive, you know, we've now created the non-geographical but geographical entity. We've got beyond the Sunni bid for mastery within Iraq. We're a global community. But how do you set ISIK, Khorasan, in that context?
I'm going to answer that, but before I'm going to just add something to what you were saying, which is there is clearly a really powerful role for the media and the branding in creating that. Mm. And at its height of the caliphate in Raqqa, they were publishing Darbik in 10 languages simultaneously. Yeah. So that's
the magazine,
Darbik. That's the magazine. And now if you look at it, which you probably can't, and indeed I haven't, but I believe this to be true because others have, the Khorasan sort of media arm, Al-Azaim, that's being published now simultaneously in Uzbek, Tajik, Pashto, Russian, Dari, Arabic, Urdu, Farsi, Hindi, Malayalam, and English. So you've got, again, exactly as you're saying, firstly, a definite attempt not to be bound by one group, one geographic boundary, and Voice of Khorasan as well is just their English magazine, who knows exactly where that's being published. The second bit about this is the capability that this demonstrates. Mm. I mean, just imagine, Alistair, if you were publishing Engelsberg Ideas in Tajik, Pashto, Russian, Dari, Arabic, Urdu,
Farsi. A dream of publishing Engelsberg Ideas in Dari, Pashto.
But, you know, what would you need to do? I mean, you produce a magazine. What would you need to produce a magazine?
It would be a vast enterprise. It would cost loads of money, actually. Yeah.
So that's it. So every time you kind of look at this, and it's easy to kind of write it down and put it on the internet that says it produces this in all these languages. But then you think, well, what kind of level of organisation do you need to do that?
Yeah.
And that's a lot. So I'm using this to answer your question because I have prefaced everything by, I don't actually know, because I'm not seeing this, because this is Uzbeks and Tajiks and people who are really cross with the Taliban of all different ethnic backgrounds and beliefs. I think that clearly they're organised.
But I think it's better to preface it, I don't know, than the commentary you've seen after. I think a lot of the commentary about the Croker City Hall outrage, in the West anyway, you know, in American papers, is framed in language which was used 10 years ago to describe the Bataclan attacks, the wave of terrorism that we saw in Europe, quite understandably, because it has a familiar feel. It's a concert venue, there's the kind of accoutrements of the Islamic State, you know, the statements, photographs, all that stuff. But the more uncomfortable reality may be that it's not Islamic State projecting power into the West or doing that. It's something new and something a bit different and coming from a bit of the world that we don't necessarily understand or know very well.
Totally. So number one thing about Islamic State, in my experience, is they don't make false claims, like David Berry said once a long time ago. But if they claim something, they have a reputation to uphold as well. From the very beginning, they put some effort into working out whether it was actually something that was then going to be exposed as not being them. So if they claim something, I tend to believe it. What's interesting, and I've been following Mino Alami, who works for BBC Monitoring on this, is that they haven't claimed this in the name of a particular branch. And that's quite unusual.
Yeah.
That may indicate a little bit of confusion. Not everything is organised completely.
No, I'm big on the opportunist. I really disagree on the opportunistic angle. There's so little strategy involved. I think it would be in a money who's available on the spot, spotting the opportunity sort of thing.
But is that strategy or is that tactics? I've been having this conversation with Charlie Lederman and, to some extent, Will James, who both at KCL, who talk about Britain's grand strategy. And I've come back at them and said, but if you look at this, the really grand strategy that we're seeing playing out is this really long-term, continuous thread of the, I don't know, Islamist, jihadist, revolutionary movement that started, really kind of kick-started with Said Qutb, Abdullah Azzam, Ayman al-Zawahiri. They laid out a blueprint that is still being followed. And along the way, there have been different groups, different tactical ways of trying to bring it about in a way, but it is still a continuous path.
Yeah, and I'm sympathetic to that. The fantasy of violence is a stepping point to the utopia you then build. You know, that ecstatic violence that terrorist outrages represent, you know, it's various steps on the road to paradise. And that is realised in an entity which is in the here and now, which threatens our security, which is here.
Yeah.
But then I do think there is a kind of psychopathology at work. You know, I think some of these people have more in common with Anders Breivik, with other mass shooters, with even like the Columbine massacres, than they do with a revolutionary figure like Lenin, for example, someone who did have a long-term view, who was building, who saw violence in terms which were utilitarian, but always had that long-term view in the back of his head. I don't know. I also think there's a bit of a commonality with other radicals who go in for extreme violence. But the thing about this attack is it doesn't really fit that framework. So it probably doesn't show what I believe.
No, I don't think it does show what you believe. I think it shows what I believe.
That's what I've thought for... Yeah. But that's what I've thought for a long time about... It's a thought that makes me feel comfortable about terrorism, that it's merely a kind of fantasy of violence that will play itself out. It's a kind of revolt of young people against their elders, which I think there's a half-truth there. So much of the literature of Islamic State is about tearing down the world of your forefathers and also tearing down the world of other people's forefathers. So they'll say, you know, we're not just going to destroy the false worlds of ignorance that are... parents and grandparents were involved with, people who compromised with the West, who compromised on Islam. It's, we're going to turn your children, your Western children, against you and tear down your monuments in turn. It's this kind of year zero for everyone thing. I thought it was interesting about the statement that Islamic State made about the attack. It doesn't reference Russia's interventions in the Middle East. It only says these are crusaders.
if you look at, which you now can't because it's been taken down, thankfully, from the internet, Osama bin Laden's letter to the American people. Yeah. Actually, I mean, there's a whole list of things that America's done wrong, of which there is a grain of truth in all of them, which is what makes it problematic. But the core message is, if you're a democratic country and you have voted for a government that is committing these things that we disagree with, you, the citizens, are a legitimate target. Yeah. And I think if you look at the claim, I don't know whether this is complicated because of when it will go out or not, but the Islamic State, Khorasan, have a proper branch, have put out a statement a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
So firstly...
Yeah, it slightly hedges its bets, doesn't it?
Well, who does it go after? It goes after the Afghan Taliban.
Yeah.
For seeking relations with the United States, Russia, China and other countries. So you've got local politics mixed up in there. And what's not there, I mean, I haven't read all of it, but it's not a headline thing that says we're doing this for the Palestinians. And that's interesting because, of course, the Islamic State, really complicatedly, aren't on the same side as Hamas.
Yeah.
So I would have expected, if I had been Islamic State and I had conducted a big terrorist attack in Russia, I would have been seeking to take the Palestinian thing and put it front and centre of the claim, because that's the thing that's going to get you a huge amount of... I mean, because jihadi groups, they're business groups, and you're trying to recruit more people than your opponents. You want to be the best at terrorism, in a way.
And you've seen that dynamic before with al-Nusra being basically... You know, they were outcompeted in the market.
So they're always, and certainly in Central Asia or bits of Afghanistan, Pakistan, the most powerful jihadi group controls the area. They get the twin cabs, they get the guns, all of that. So what's really interesting about the statement from Islamic State Khorasan, which doesn't claim the attack in Russia, it glorifies it, which is a totally different thing. But then the real focus of the message that it's putting out is a local one, which says the Taliban have completely sold out, they're in bed with the Russians and the Chinese, and it's about power politics inside Afghanistan and trying to destabilise that region. I don't know whether you saw, again, the Pakistan state fired missiles into two areas of Afghanistan, aiming at Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, which is the Pakistani Taliban, which is not the same as the Afghan Taliban, confusingly, because they've got the same name, so everyone assumes that they're the same, but they're not quite. And then the accusation being levelled at the Taliban is, you should be stopping all of this happening. And that's a really interesting question, because now suddenly you've got the Taliban, as you were saying, that they're kind of the old guys, except they're not all old, but they are the establishment suddenly.
Yeah.
Who are responsible for stopping terrorism.
And but also in the interpreters of religious truth, you know. And I think that's a huge difference between what Islamic State has always been, which is young people, is always that Chinese Cultural Revolution almost quality to Islamic State, that it's all about saying that the religious authorities that we had, our parents, our forefathers, they followed, were all wrong. We're kind of going to come for them.
I would say that, being that I am some decades older than you, Alistair, I would say that people get more extreme as they get older, apart from the ones who get tired.
Yeah.
And so if you look at Abu Bakr Baghdadi, who's the same age as me, he wasn't a young man, he was a middle-aged man. So it's not the case at the moment. The current leader of Islamic State Khorasan is a young man. I think he's 29 or something. So I think, rather than young or old, the division is when to compromise about to achieve your political aims. It's about kind of revolutionary theory, essentially.
Yeah.
When do you accept that you've got as much as you're going to get and be happy with that? And when do you keep fighting? And so the Taliban have always had a sort of fixed aim, which is to rule the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Yeah. Daesh have a totally different fixed aim, which is a caliphate, and then the end of the world.
Yeah.
So,
And relentless expansion
and all of this. But I was thinking, as you were talking then as well, about Imam Shamil, this is my other contention, that it's just no use calling everyone criminals, because there is deep history to this tension between Islamist political movements at the point where they border Western imperial endeavour. And we had it in British India, again, in the Northwest Frontier, the Hindustani fanatics, the Fakir of Ippi, who fought against Britain in the 1930s and lived, I mean, he lived to old age, Fakir of Ippi. And it's the same with Imam Shamil, who was Dagestani leader in the 1830s, who lived until, I mean, he died in Mecca in his 70s. He fought the Russians for 25 years, from 1832 to 1859, as the third imam of the Caucasus. So I think the difference with today's movement, in a way, is the kind of impatience and the populism, which is sort of get jihad done. And that was what happened. And I reviewed for you, Antonio Gistozzi, I can't say his name properly, book about IS Khorasan, the tension between the Taliban, who'd been fighting this long war of attrition with the Americans, and other groups, particularly the Uzbeks, particularly elements of the Pakistani Taliban, who just said, oh, this is tedious. Mullah Omar's been dead for 2 years and you've been covering it up. This is ridiculous. We've just got to do something differently.
Yeah. But if we could rewind to Osama bin Laden, it's very sophisticated what he did, blaming elements within the American security hierarchy for 9/11. They don't claim 9/11 initially, at least, and it's the conspiracy theory. I'm trying to recall precisely what he said. He sort of went, well, you know, who knows what reasons the Americans had for arranging this. You know, it's all about funding, it's all about the war on drugs, it's all about all these kind of noughties conspiracy theories. And it's not surprising that bin Laden's views have acquired a kind of latent popularity, because he draws on lots of popular culture themes that are quite significant in the West, not least in America, with the conspiratorial vein and the idea that there's always a deep state behind American politics, behind the scenes, organising stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the risk is we're having a Western argument. We're having a Western argument, and it doesn't work because we naturally disesteem conspiracy theories. And just, I'm going to undermine all my credibility, but just because they're not true doesn't mean they're not true.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. So the thing, and we, again, I've written about this for you, Alistair, but the thing that Osama bin Laden did so well was just nail a narrative which is very persuasive, which is you, the West, have invaded our countries, exploited our resources, stolen, enslaved our people. You have committed more violence than anybody else. America dropped the atomic bomb. You are hypocrites. And, you know, we talk about this, but you are hypocrites. We are hypocrites. We're all hypocrites. Everybody's hypocrites. So it doesn't really work, but you're hypocrites. Leaders of our countries who support you are corrupt vassals and apostates. Yeah. And, you know, you are, and basically you are depraved. It's the Saib Qutb line. You know, your society is disintegrating. You commit bestial acts. You are evil. You are from Satan. And that's really powerful message that resonates a large parts of the world, different bits of it.
Yeah.
You can add to it, you can use it for different. So Putin has used almost exactly the same argument, that focus on good and evil, Satan, really resonates with people who believe in good and evil. It doesn't resonate with large parts of our society. We think, oh, we're banging on about Satan. But actually, if you have a strong belief, and you believe that the others are Satan, you're motivated to act in a different way. So it does really matter, the sort of fundamental argument or fundamental persuasive narrative, on which can be then layered whatever you want, whatever grievances you want. So in the case of the Central Asians or the Caucasus, your grievance is projected at Russia for obvious historical reasons, and it always will be. That doesn't mean you're not also going to attack Western targets if you can. And I do agree with you on opportunity. I mean, that's the whole point about the just do it terrorism.
Well, that's where I always thought the reason why France suffered so many terrorist attacks, because there were lots of people available.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily about France's specific history, although that obviously plays a part in why there were so many people. But there was an opportunity and people take it.
Yeah.
There's an element of contingency at work. You know, it's not necessarily about what France has done in the last 10, 20 years in foreign policy terms. If that were the case, there would have been a difference with not being involved in Iraq. You know, there would have been...
Yeah, although they got very involved in North Africa. And,
exactly.
And it really picked up after, was it Hollande sent the troops in? So it really did pick up after that. And I think there is that narrative that I've just explained. It's very easy to make a narrative that says you should attack France because of history. And it's the same. Actually, this brings me on to something I did want to talk about, which is diaspora communities.
Mm.
And all of this creates really intricate relationship handling problems for countries with large diaspora communities whose homeland has this kind of instability in it. So for the UK, we had very clearly in sort of 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, a problem with the British Pakistani community, the Kashmiri community, who had been very much influenced by the Kashmiri Jihad, who had had direct crossover and experience with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and who then brought that experience back in different ways and conducted terrorist attacks here. The French have the same problem with their diaspora community. The interesting thing now is about the Central Asian diaspora communities in Europe, because it's a stronger diaspora across Eastern Europe because, again, of history, because of the Soviet Union. The Germans have had very strong connections with Kazakhstan. They've always had to the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which has become part of IS Khorasan in complicated ways that I'm not going to try and explain. They've always had links into Germany because of connections between various leaders of IMU throughout the last sort of 20, 30 years. And Sweden has a strong Uzbek community. 2.5 million Kazakhs moved to Germany in the first 3 years after the fall of Soviet Union, because they were, you know, they were Germans who'd been in Kazakhstan during, you know, taken there by Stalin. So that's where you have this really interesting play about threat and opportunity in Europe.
Yeah.
And I was just looking on the internet again, so I'm not presuming to be an expert on this, but there is an increasing number of people emigrating from Central Asia to the UK compared to... It's not typically been a connection, but once you have family members here, then it starts to grow.
There are local grievances at play. It's a more sophisticated, complex organism. The antidote is not quite so straightforward.
We had this very clearly in the UK with the British Kashmiri community, is you can't try and persuade them not to do terrorism only by talking to them in the UK if you don't understand the other half of their lives, which at that stage was people like Ilyas Kashmiri, leaders of Harakat al-Jihad al-Islami. And they were, you know, they were fighting the Indians and they were going out there in summer holidays and learning how to shoot guns and plant bombs and understanding that that is a part of people's identity and sense of who they are is important. The reason it's going to be a challenge now with IS Khorasan is that in order really to understand the IMU, the Uzbeks, you've got to spend time in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And so it's exactly the time when we're all retrenching and saying, this is about Russia and China, this, you know, the West is an existential threat with a set of great powers, so we're in great power competition mode. We're at risk then of saying we're going to reduce our money that we're spending on terrorism, and it's actually too far away and too complicated, therefore we'll just deal with it in a treat them as criminals sort of way. And I suppose
the Alistair Benn approach.
The Alistair Benn approach. But yeah, I mean, of course you have to be investigating, arresting, stopping terrorism. Of course there is an element of that which is criminal investigation. But actually as well, if you really want to come up with a long-term approach for this, you're going to have to put more effort into understanding what's going on in that northern territory of Afghanistan, which seems to be where IS Khorasan is now kind of fixed, reaching upwards. Or you can decide that this is Russia's problem. and we're just going to hope that it doesn't come back to bite us. But my experience would lead me to believe that thinking it's someone else's problem and it won't come back to bite us is not a long-term plan, because sooner or later it will. What they do, because they're appealing, as we discussed earlier, they're appealing across the globe.
That's the interesting thing about the different statements. You know, it's like different audiences in different markets. You know, for some people sitting in their basements in Britain or in Europe who read the Islamic State statement, they say, oh, you know, this is inspirational. They won't know anything about Tajik politics. You know, what they'll see in the attack is Christian crusaders being slaughtered by fanatics, but then people in Central Asia may see it as a very different thing. It's part of a struggle against forces in their own country, like the Taliban, who have sold out to Russia, who've sold out on their vision of inspirational Islam.
But, or the Central Asian leaders who are, you know, again, in bed with the Russians.
We don't necessarily want to talk about people who believe in good and evil and things. That opens up a space, an imaginative space, for very, very extreme forms of inspirational action.
Yeah.
Rooted around religious cults. Even in Christianity, religion has become less and less about the local culture. It's become more about kind of inspirational visions, evangelizing, particularly among young people. That's what the most popular forms of Christianity are, those inspirational evangelizing ones. They're not the ones that are rooted in kind of other cultural traditions. So it's not necessarily the violence is the common thread. It's the fact that in the West in particular, religion is becoming less and less about national culture. It's becoming more about individual choice and about a global vision.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I'm reading a book by Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware at the moment called God, Guns and Sedition, which describes the problem in America at the moment, but it shows the development of that kind of accelerationist movement out of the 70s and 80s, which was this complicated mix of kind of Christianity, white supremacism, anti-Semitism, millenarianism, all kind of, again, all mushed up together. The timeline is quite interesting because it does seem to have all come up in the 70s. So you had the Juhayman al-Otaibi, who was the one who really revived all the apocalyptic hadith, who led the siege of the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979. So that was the sort of grand strategic turning point in our sort of experience of the Islamist.
And that did change Saudi life, you know, significantly. Yeah. That had a huge effect on Saudi Arabia.
Well, all terrorism has huge effects. You know, we say that it doesn't, but I argue, I think persuasively, that Islamist terrorists have had a greater strategic impact on us, on our foreign policy, on our society, how we relate to each other, what we teach in schools, our cultural experiences. If you go into a museum or a gallery or a concert now, you're going to have your bag searched, you're going to have to go through an X-ray machine. The introduction of the new Protect Duty, which is going to fundamentally change our experience of public spaces. Mm. That's all come from the series of terrorist attacks perpetrated against America and the West. And actually, you look at Russia, you know, the Second Chechen War was begun because of bombings of apartment buildings in Russia, which may or may not have been conducted by terrorists. I know all that is up for debate. And then the Moscow theatre siege, the Beslan school thing. You know,
there's a Potemkin strategic security apparatus in Russia. So if you go to the Moscow subway, there are metal detectors when you go in and people with guns. But you walk straight through. It doesn't feel particularly serious. And I wonder if a little bit with the Croker City Hall, there's security, but it's not really, you know, it's not taking it seriously.
So I think the problem for all society is how you keep people
why
safe.
Why have they been much more successful in, or maybe they haven't, I don't know, but let's look at the IRA, which did carry out sophisticated terror attacks in this country, away from Northern Ireland, over a long, long period. In France, you had numerous terror movements, which were really about Algeria, ultimately. In Germany, you had the Baader-Meinhof group, who were very effective. You know, I mean, a number of people who died in terror, and they had an international dimension, you know, with the Palestinian PLO and also with the Japanese Red Army as well. Did they change the way we live in subtle ways? Probably. Why has...
Massively.
Were they stepping stones to what we see now? Were they partly the inspiration? Did they set the template as well?
Well,
even though these groups didn't share a huge deal with what, you know, Islamic fundamentalists want.
So there are some fantastic histories of terrorism,
yeah.
which do show clearly how different groups learnt from each other. Again, I wrote something for you about the Orsini bomb, which was developed in the 1850s, not to a British design, but developed in Britain. Let's be clear that British engineers designed this bomb, which was the first time that, I mean, it's sort of basically the model of a hand grenade. So it was small, portable, you put it in your pocket, you threw it at something, it exploded. It was first thrown at Emperor Napoleon III in France. It was designed very similar, that was used to kill Tsar Alexander II in Russia.
Yeah.
And it was all about challenging the state's monopoly on violence. And since then, the basic premise has been the same. The state no longer has the monopoly on violence. Sometimes it is necessary to conduct extreme violence to achieve your political objective. That poses a real problem for states. And we were talking before we started about the Russian nihilists. So there's a lot of credit for developing the sort of extreme terrorist way is given to the Russian nihilists.
Dostoevsky's Demons, an unforgettable account of that as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's, and then this is, I can't, is it Nachayev? Nachayev, I don't know how you pronounce it. Let's say that. But it's a wonderful quote from him that gives you that insight. And then I think we'll finish. Shall I read this?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
The revolutionist is a doomed man. He has no private interests, no affairs, sentiments, ties, property, nor even a name of his own. His entire being is devoured by one purpose, one thought, one passion, the revolution. Heart and soul, not merely by word, but by deed. He has severed every link with the social order and with the entire civilised world. With the laws, good manners, conventions and morality of that world, he is its merciless enemy and continues to inhabit it with only one purpose, to destroy it.
Thanks to Suzanne Rain. You've been listening to EI Talks. EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Until next time, thanks for listening.